I mean, like, there's almost a view which is maybe the browser's like toast. Like, we won't really have browsers in the future.
I think the browser is still kind of your first entry point into a lot of, you know, tools, applications. You want to find something, you typically go to a browser. So AI-based search functionality is really the conduit in which I think a lot of these tools and technologies and applications are still going to be accessed.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the most brilliant minds in technology to banter, analyze, and argue our way through the thrilling and often baffling news each week in artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by a great crew. We've got Shobhit Varshney here, head of data and AI consulting for US, Canada, and Latin America. Abraham Daniels, senior technical product manager for Granite. And Sophie Kutz, joining us for the very first time, IBM distinguished engineer and CTO for IBM NCEE. We have a packed episode today, as always. We'll cover Grok Imagine, check in on GPT-5, and cover Perplexity's bid for Google Chrome. But first, starting today, we're going to have a quick segment at the beginning of each episode that talks about the top news stories from each week. And that's going to be helmed by Eileen McConnon. Eileen, over to you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Eileen McConnon. I'm a tech news writer for IBM Think. Before we dive into the episode, I'm here with a few quick AI headlines you may have missed this busy week. First up, chip makers NVIDIA and AMD have reached an unprecedented arrangement where they will give the U.S. government 15% of their revenues of chip sales in China. Apple is planning several new AI devices, including a tabletop robot that will serve as a virtual companion. And another AI enhancement Apple's planning is more lifelike sounding Siri that will be able to communicate with multiple people at the same time. Meanwhile, in case you missed this interesting piece of research, Anthropic found that five major AI assistants, including Claude, ChatGPT, and Llama, are people pleasers. The AI assistants systematically gave biased feedback and inaccurate information, all in order to flatter their human users and provide answers that aligned with their views. Last but not least, Google DeepMind has released an updated open-source version of its PERCH bioacoustics model. This is going to help conservationists analyze wildlife audio and better protect endangered species. Want to dive deeper into some of these topics? Subscribe to the Think newsletter. It's linked in the show notes. And now back to our episode.
So first, I really wanted to talk about Perplexity. So this was a perplexing bit of news that popped up this week. It came out that Perplexity, the sort of AI search tool that many of you will be familiar with, has made a bid for Google's Chrome browser, which many of you, you know, maybe even watching the show on, for the small price of $34.5 billion. So we're going to get a little bit into why this is happening, why they would price so much, what this is actually is even for. But first, I just want to start with a fun question, which is, would you, if you ran Google, sell Chrome to Perplexity for $34.5 billion? Abraham, yes or no? What do you think?
I would not, no.
Okay, great. Shobhit, how about you?
No, not at all.
Okay, and Sophie, how about you?
No, sorry, also not for me.
Okay, great. Well, we have unanimity on this. I guess maybe a good place to start is maybe, Shobhit, I'll start with you, is why is Perplexity doing this? And is this a real bid? Are they really trying to buy Chrome?
There are about 3.5 billion users of Google Chrome. Like, a lot of us have been on Google Chrome for years and decades. So that's a stickiness factor to it. So I think the intention here is to just, the actual number is not as relevant as the fact that we are starting to line up actual bidders for part of the Chrome to move the conversation forward. I've been a very active user, power user of Google, of Perplexity's own browser, Comet. I think we're all heading in the right direction of having browsers become more and more intelligent. Microsoft did the same thing with their Edge browser by adding a Copilot to it and so on and so forth. So I think over time, you will start to move into more intelligent ways of looking at various websites and how we interact with them. But the dollar amount itself is not as relevant. There have been multiple valuations of Chrome as a unit, which place it at $50 billion plus. There's some that even call it a $1 trillion property for Google, right? But the whole intention is this is so critical to Google in its old ecosystem that this is just trying to drive a public opinion that, hey, we should be splitting it up into more.
Yeah, for sure. Sophie, maybe I'll turn to you. I mean, when you responded to my question, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you were like, No, hell no. If I ran Google, I would definitely not sell Chrome. Why shouldn't Google sell Chrome? I mean, it's a lot of money, isn't it? Like, this is a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely. And to Shobit's point, it's kind of an opener, right? And it pulls a lot of attention to both of the companies. But I think what I see is definitely that more and more of these AI applications are meeting the users where they are, and this is definitely, yeah, also from Perplexity point of view, a very interesting consideration. Also, they originated very much from search, and they distinguish themselves from other applications with that. So I can definitely understand why Perplexity is interested. And I think, from Google perspective, Chrome is one of the big outboards for them to reach a lot of users where they are as well. So that is, I think for Google still something to cherish and keep.
So Abraham, so far we've been talking a little bit about like $34.5 billion. It's a lot of money. You know, maybe it's not a real number. Maybe it's an opening bid. Maybe we could talk a little bit about product and technology here, which is obviously Perplexity with the Comet browser is trying to say that the future of AI is going to be really in the browser, right? And certainly a purchase of Chrome or an attempted purchase of Chrome only emphasizes that more, right? Like, which is I'm an AI company. I'm going to try to buy one of the biggest browsers in the world. It's all really kind of emphasizing this point that they think that the form factor for AI in the future is going to be the browser, basically. Do you buy that? I mean, like, there's almost a view which is maybe the browser's like toast. Like, we won't really have browsers in the future. So curious about what you think about, like, the browser really being the kind of core platform for where AI is going.
Yeah, I think the browser is still kind of your first entry point into a lot of, you know, tools, applications. So it's still kind of your first contact point in terms of using the internet. If you want to find something, you typically go to a browser. So AI-based search functionality is really the conduit in which I think a lot of these tools and technologies and applications are still going to be accessed. In terms of the actual bid, I think this is more of like a marketing ploy for Perplexity. So, I mean, the article you shared, one, the valuation of Perplexity is half of what they've offered as part of the actual bid. So, you know, realistically speaking, they say, hey, they have VCs backed up to, you know, cover the rest of the cost. But, you know, that's a lot of money to make up for. Also, it was interesting that they gave about a week, I saw, as part of the letter for
the it was an exploding offer, which is like, you have to kind of appreciate how audacious it was.
That's just,
I think,
ridiculous. You know, a $34 billion offer, you know, sure, twice your valuation, and you give to the end of Friday to be able to have a response. So I think this is great. I think they did the same thing with TikTok as well in terms of potentially making a bid for it. This is great in terms of getting Comet out there, getting people to, you know, clickbait on, you know, what is Perplexity? Why are they trying to, you know, purchase Chrome? And really just gravitating towards that, you know, free marketing for Perplexity and Chrome, their browser. Also, Google is, you know, they lost their antitrust. So in the worst case scenario, they have to fully divest from Chrome. So I think this really just sets the one price point, the entry price point for what Chrome could potentially be worth. This is the first, like, you know, public pricing. And then also, I think it establishes Perplexity as, or at least in some type of mind share, it establishes Perplexity as a potential, you know, next up for, you know, ubiquitous search engine. So
I'll make two quick comments. I think there was just the fact that you said this audacious bid. On LinkedIn, I've had multiple small startups, CEOs, just make audacious bids, $10 billion to buy Perplexity. Right? It's just meta at this point, right? People are just making these audacious bids as if this is very hypothetical. This shows you where we are with the Silicon Valley hype cycle. But I think from my perspective, my biggest use of my Comet Perplexity browser has been actually in enterprise workflows. Versus the way all the discussion so far we've focused is on consumer. And that consumer interface is actually going to change a lot faster than enterprise, right? So we're going to move to our mobile and voice and things of that nature much faster. But if I'm logged into my SaaS tools that I use for my day-to-day work, it could be Salesforce, it could be SAP or Workdays or whatever else, right? Those workflows, it has been terrible trying to get that automation to get embedded into those SaaS tools, right? And so far, we've been waiting for the SaaS providers to provide us some AI agents that'll go automate some workflows. And that is not consistent across all the SaaS vendors. Some of the bigger ones, obviously deep pocketed, can automate faster. But these buying a browser that has AI baked in and has agents that can act on your behalf, now all of a sudden I'm able to go into my SaaS tools like Salesforce of the world to go automate the workflows that I have to do because I have an agent sitting on the right-hand side I just can describe. So you'll be surprised how quick I'm doing my expenses right now in SAP Concur, right? So that's my killer use cases. I really, I think enterprises will have more separation anxiety from the browser than we in our individual personal lives.
That's super interesting. Yeah, and I really didn't think about that because I think I was thinking about it very much Shobit as a consumer. And I say, well, it is true. I'm using my like desktop Claude, my desktop ChatGPT more and more in a way that's actually substituting for the browser. But I almost love the idea that actually this is not a consumer thing, right? Really, like the argument for the browser being the key platform for AI is an enterprise thing, which is like very, very, very interesting. I like that a lot. Sophie, any final thoughts on this? I'm kind of curious about like where you think this all goes. And I think, you know, ultimately, I think kind of the question is, where is kind of Google in all this, right? Like, what are they going to do next? How do they play the game? I'm curious about your kind of thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely say something on that, and also to Shobit's point, the competition on where what is then the key platform to entry. I think that is something we will see more and more things to come. Where is it the entry point for the enterprise users? What will be that part for the future? So where is Google heading to? I think with this this potential split up of products, it needs to make up they need to make up their mind as well on where to focus on, I think their business model is still very much on the advertising part. So I think that we will see a lot more happening over the coming time, and will be more clear on where they will heading towards. But this bidding will definitely speed things up as well.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Wanted to talk a little bit about sort of Grok Imagine, but more generally about kind of like the rise of generative video. And I think in some ways, Grok Imagine is a really interesting feature for us to talk a little bit about. There's been, you know, Elon Musk in his usual way, I think, is like promoting it very, very aggressively. And now on X, you may have seen that you can just sort of animate images by pressing and holding on them, right, is the feature that they've been advertising. But I actually really wanted to talk less maybe about Grok and more about how Grok is pitching its video generation features. So Elon Musk had this very interesting comment where he said, look, Grok Imagine, our video generation technologies, they're going to be like the new Vine, right? Which is referring to this short form video platform, very popular in kind of like the old, you know, classic era of Twitter. And I think it's really interesting to think a little bit about like where generative video goes, because I think certainly what, you know, X seems to have in mind is the idea is that, you know, you watch TikTok. You like short form video. Well, okay, well, we can just generate endless versions of that now just through generative AI, i.e. this is going to be a media feature, right? This is the way the future is going to go. But I think a lot of people are also like, this is really expensive to run video generation, right? And so I think one of the things I want to ask is like whether or not we think video generation is going to be a consumer feature over time or will really be more of an enterprise feature with time where, you know, the main use cases are going to be Hollywood and video editors and people who are power users of like the Adobe Creative Suite, you know, if that's really where things are going, or if we really do think that this is going to be sort of like the media of the future. Shobit, you're already going off mute, so I'll let you just go.
I was at the AI4 conference. I was giving a talk this week, and I got into three conversations with actual media producers, with all the big different banners. And I had this particular conversation around digital, all the creative generative AI making videos and stuff. One of the biggest hurdles across the industry right now is IP. The training content that has gone into these video generation images and stuff, they prohibit you from actually using it for anything that is commercially usable. Unless we can clearly articulate what happens on the data that went into the training, who owns the copyrights, and Adobe has done a far better job than some of the peers on training on actual clean licensed data. Unless we solve for that, this will not enter the enterprises.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a really good argument for one of the reasons why the consumer kind of application of this technology has legs is, you know, it's a little easier from an IP standpoint. The norms are a little bit more open. Abraham, maybe a question for you is, are you a TikTok user at all?
I am not, no.
Okay, got it. Do you enjoy short-form video, or are you like, don't even want to touch it?
No, well, I was part of the Vine generation. So.
Okay, so so you remember. And I guess the question for you is like, is a computer-generated Vine, is like a generative AI Vine the same experience? Like, do you think eventually we will just have like, it's either TikTok or, you know, Grok Imagine, like that these two are actually substitutable in some sense?
So no, just because of the cultural context behind some of, like, again, speaking specifically to Vine, the cultural context behind a lot of the images or videos that were created, and then the pulling the thread through the video and the actual, your real life experience, where if it's created on demand, it doesn't really tie as well. But I think that Grok image is really kind of connecting, you know, to that audience, as, you know, most of Twitter users, or I guess X now, are within that Vine, you know, previous life. They grew up on Vine. They grew up on these tools. Truthfully, I echo a lot of the same sentiments that Chobit did in terms of where this is actually going to play out. So, you know, short form, obviously playful media generation, I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the adoption. You've already kind of seen a lot of the adoption where there's minimal moderation requirements. I think there's a big controversy around deepfakes that needs to be answered and really needs to be talked about a little bit more loudly in terms of, you know, what we're allowed to create with these models, and whether that's putting guardrails on the actual, APIs, or, you know, policing the output a little bit more so in terms of what's found. But yeah, from having this move from a, you know, C2C or B2C to like a B2B, I think we're quite a ways from there. There's going to be quite a bit of oversight and compliance and, you know, brand safety content guardrails that we have to really enable. But yeah, from the perspective of just playing around, like I see this as basically just another cool tool as opposed to something that's really going to fundamentally change, you know, enterprise use cases and business models.
Sophie, I'm one of my reflections of the AI era that I think is always very funny is like you've built like the most complex advanced technologies, you know, known to humanity. And then it's like, I really need you to format some JSON, or like I really need you to clean up this code and remove white space. And I think I have a similar reaction to video, which is video generation is really, really resource intensive. It's really, really expensive to do. Is this sustainable to offer it as a consumer platform? Because it just feels like if you were to really price the actual price of generating these videos, you know, you would be talking a subscription service, which is like really, really expensive. So curious about like if you think the dollars and cents even work out for offering this feature as like a broad mass feature for kind of playful content generation like Abraham's talking about.
Yeah, no, and I think we've seen since the launch of generative AI always in this model, right? It comes out, people can use it for free, they get used to working with it, and then it goes into another form which is paid, or it goes into new kind of applications, and in that sense it's a similar launch that we see here, but it's so convenient to use, and it's indeed for many generations also addictive, and it plays really to the need of a lot of what people like. What I think what is truly missing is the transparency around what is used, how is it used, and what is it consuming, right? Indeed, if you would be aware about how much resources would really be needed to create something and make people conscious of it, and that is a missed chance that is also lacking with a lot of these applications, to make your users aware of what it is, and then so allowing them to make also a conscious choice in using this. So I think it's a typical launch of a new thing, and it makes it very convenient for a lot of users now to start thinking in more video created content.
Yeah. And I think actually, I don't know, Chobit, you went off mute. So I don't know if you were going to ask the same question I was, but, you know, I think both Abraham and Chobit have referenced like this technology is very fun, but we need to kind of like make sure that it's like operated and deployed with the right sort of ethical guidelines. And I'm kind of curious if you have recommendations on that front, right? I mean, lots of companies are offering generative AI video now. And I'm curious if you're, in your experience, there's, you know, specific best practices, things that you think people should kind of keep in mind, particularly listeners of the show, maybe deploying this technology. And we'd love to get kind of your thoughts and tips on, you know, how people have been doing it well.
So let me give you an actual example. Back in April, I was at the Google Next event. We're massive partners with them. We were at the Sphere in Vegas. I'm not sure if you guys have gone to this massive Sphere. It's just absolutely a phenomenal experience to sit in the middle and have this whole spherical environment around you. And it was the launch of Wizard of Oz. That video, they've been partnering with the studio to take that Wizard of Oz that was very small and then scale it out on this huge mega platform in 360 degrees around you, right? So this is working with the owners of the actual content. And it's a very complex problem, right? If you think about the fact that, hey, your screen has, say, a few characters who come trotting in, dancing, and then they leave. Now, if you're extrapolating it out on the whole sphere, you need to have the characters actually show up somewhere else and walk all the way through. Somebody's hiding behind a tree that should be visible to you, and then you pan into that. So it takes a lot to generate that kind of video. But that was a phenomenal example of content owners working with these AI models with the right guardrails and guidelines, what can and cannot be done, and extrapolate from there. I think we need to do enough. Right now, we're in that phase where these generative models are still learning. They need a lot more direction on what is okay and what is not. They need more training data that is good, approved, clean training data. I think that particular, the phase that we are in right now, should be more constrained and should be a good partnership between content owners and the AI model creators. I'm a little scared when we start to open these models up when they're not quite ready yet. They would not understand what would be okay and what is not okay. There's not been a good feedback loop from humans to even detect. Even things like if a particular video or image is not suitable for Facebook or Instagram and stuff like that, it took us a long while to create the right filtering processes. So Facebook, as an example, Meta, Jan LeCun had shared this information. Back in the days, it used to take them a lot of compute to figure out even a quarter of the images or posts and flag them ahead of time for governance. Now with the large language models, 92-94% of those images that are not suitable and stuff like that are being flagged because the LLMs have been trained to have the right guardrails and do this at scale. So I think the technology is getting there. We will need the right frameworks and guidelines and whose definition of guidelines do we share. It may change between you and me. What I'm okay looking at or what I'm okay my kids looking at is going to be very different. So we'll need to have some personalization of those guardrails. We need the technology to get a lot more mature with the right training, curated training and stuff like that before we start to open it out to mass production. But I think this kind of a partnership, like what Google did, is the right direction forward. And now these are starting to get more and more open source as well. Genie 3 was an amazing model. I loved working with it. Now we have an open source version of it as well that people are attempting to get to. So I think as we start to think about this open ecosystem, people can see how these models are being trained, what's the data coming in, and so on and so forth. I think we'll progressively as a community do a lot better at this.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think especially if you want to scale this to enterprise use, right, that always starts with a lot of an education and enablement and thinking about what is it indeed, what are the values that we want to see back in the usage of this. And what I call that as transparency, that's one of the big guardrails that would help a lot if people know what models are used and also in the whole IP discussion, what happens then, and also make that clear and also have the guidance to publish that together with the video, then we have a lot more options to discuss. And alternative, and people can also think about alternatives then, right? Because, but I think that's a step in the maturity also, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that like kind of the idea is like as the technology matures, there's just kind of a stages that you sort of move through, and the problems you sort of need to solve as you go. I'm going to move us on to our final topic here of the day. Maybe the obvious topic to talk about, which is GPT-5. It has been, of course, dominating headlines all across my social media. I can't get away from GPT-5. And I know last week we actually did our kind of like breaking news episode for Quick Takes. But the pace of AI moves so quickly that I think it's always good to kind of revisit a week later now that the dust has cleared more to talk a little bit about sort of like how we're feeling about GPT-5, what we thought the results of the launch were. There's a win or a loss for OpenAI. There's a lot to get into here. Chobit, maybe I'll kick it to you first. I think one kind of provocation I wanted to use to start this conversation was that there's a post by Gary Marcus, known AI critic and skeptic, who basically used the opportunity to declare victory, to basically say, look, GPT-5 shows that we are on a plateau for AI and that the current paradigm is not going to work. I'm smart. Everybody else is dumb. And that's the end of the story. And so maybe I'll just ask you the question directly. You know, a week or so on, what's your feeling about GPT-5? Is it an indicator that the current paradigm of doing AI really is hitting a plateau? And if not, why not?
So I'm pretty I truly believe that we are making massive progress every week with these models. And GPT-5 was one of the many. Even Claude and others have done some amazing work. Gemini, they've all been scaling up intelligence very, very quickly, rapidly. The cost of computers is coming down, plummeting. Access to AI has been very, very good, right? So I think overall, having access to such intelligence, I think this whole GPT-5 launch was more of OpenAI pivoting into the super app domain, right? They would like to have one central router, one central point of entry. And then at the back end, you're exposing all kinds of agents and smaller and bigger models and so on and so forth, right? So I think taking the friction away from the end user to having to pick a model and stuff like that, obviously it helps you with economics of scaling this model. But I think this starts to open up some very deep thinking models to the 700 million users who come to ChatGPT every day, right? So that's an insane access to intelligence that's available. So I think we're definitely in the right direction going forward. Now, from just on pure intelligence, I think there are a few hurdles that we still have to cross over before we truly get to start thinking about superintelligence, AGI, and so on and so forth, right? So the trajectory that we're on, one of my peers was talking about the fact that if all progress in AI stops today, we still have AI models to be able to do 40-50% of what humans do today. I kind of disagree with that statement. I believe that there are two hurdles. One was around the feedback loop on these training models, right? We do not have a good mechanism of providing feedback and adjusting the way the model works. And the second is around long-term memory, which is kind of related, but long-term memory of, hey, Chobit said something up here, and now I want that to follow through in the way I want it to transfer over to me. I think that is something that both Google and ChatGPT are doing pretty well, and they're starting to make progress around that. My most commonly used feature of ChatGPT is temporary chat. Like, I do so many temporary chats because I don't want ChatGPT to start thinking and building long-term memory about a topic that I'm searching that's not going to be relevant for anything else that I'm going to be doing. It's a one-time search thing, right? So I think those two hurdles about feedback loop mechanisms and long-term memory, how do you manage that? I think once we cross those, and that may require new algorithmic improvements to it before we can get to a point where we can get to superintelligence and AGI. But I genuinely loved the latest release of GPT-5, especially on the API side, the way I'm able to manage and for enterprise use cases, be able to tune the parameters the way I wanted, how much I want to think, and so on and so forth. This is also a good lesson in how, if from a product management perspective, they launched a product, and one of the first things they said that we're going to deprecate GPT-4.0. That's not how enterprises work, or consumers have an attachment to the way, the style and tone and things of that nature. You can't just do that when you have such a large-scale application in the field. So I think there were definitely learnings about product management, but on the core raw power, I was very, very optimistic about the direction that we are all taking once we solve for those two hurdles.
Abraham, I did definitely want to get into this last point. I mean, Chobit was doing it in his way that he does great, which is basically like, here are feature comparisons, right? Here's the improvement, here's the delta. But that final comment, I think, is so, so interesting. So I think one of the things that's kind of popped up in the news cycle of the last week is all these people who had what appears to be a pretty emotional relationship with the older models that are now being deprecated. And I'm sort of interested in your take on that, right? Because I think Chobit is right. Like, playing around with it myself, it's like, on many respects, this is just a better model, right? This is actually a real improvement. But they're kind of in this situation where it looks like almost like people kind of don't care as much about that. And what are we supposed to do about that, right? Like, do you imagine a world where these companies have to maintain these models indefinitely because people have built these relationships? Or, I don't know, I'm just like curious about getting your thoughts and takes on this kind of very fun, like, almost like legacy attachment that people have to older models. Yeah.
So I think it's less about an emotional attachment to these models and more so just understanding exactly the input output that you're going to get. So it's really being able to reproduce the same experience time and time again, so that when you do, you know, inference your model, you know the right way to inference it to get what you want out of it. And anytime you replace a model or, you know, drop a new model, there is some prompt engineering, there's some playing around with it to really get familiar with it to truly understand, okay, what is the best input for the output that I want to receive for this particular use case or this particular, you know, question. And, you know, we've dealt with that here in terms of IBM's release of Granite models, where, you know, the chat template may shift or the model, you know, stylization or output may shift from version to version. So you do get a little bit of an outcry, if you will, from users outlining, you know, I don't have the same experience I did with this model, independent of whether it's better or not. And I'm more focused, given that, you know, performance is, we're really kind of, the diminishing gains of performance don't really drive a ton of net new use cases for these models. I feel like a lot of the, you know, the net new abilities for models is really on the, what GPT-5 has kind of demonstrated, the software wrapped around the inferencing. So it's less about, hey, look, we've driven, you know, 0.1 on MMU or world's hardest test or what have you. And it's really, okay, well, how do I become proficient at using this particular model as fast as possible? And I think that's where you're really seeing the users kind of say, well, look, why would you deprecate, you know, I built an entire, you know, agent or system or workflow with GPT-4, GPT-01, and now I can't anymore. And I have to basically reproduce this with GPT-5. And
right.
I think
you're kind of saying that, like, this is just almost like it's a species of a longstanding problem, right? Which
exactly.
Well, people have built your stack on top of an old piece of software, and now you're updating.
Yeah. And also, unfortunately, OpenAI, just, it's criticized for absolutely everything it does. Everything is, you're going to have a camp that thinks everything is wrong. You're going to have a camp that thinks, you know, that everything is right with them. So I think there's a little bit of noise there that you got to siphon through. And I think that's really what the crux of the issue is, or at least from a scientific perspective or from like an actual use perspective, that's where the crux of the issue is, in my opinion.
Sure. Yeah. So if I've seen you grinning a couple times as Shobin and Abraham have talked, so I don't know if you've got a couple of reflections you want to get in.
No, I think Abraham, you played it out very well. And I think if you look at enterprise scale adoption of this, right, this is not only an IT experienced play. You see, you have many users who are not so experienced with a full IT background. So they have to get used to also working with this new update, and they have been very successful with certain use cases, and then have to keep on doing that. And I think that is also, again, plays into the maturity, but also as we do this at scale with a lot of users cross enterprise, it is so important that you have the right governance for people in place, that they can keep up when those new models come out and when new things come out. So I think, to Abraham's point, that is a difficulty. And it's also, I think, because there are a lot of new, unexperienced users that you have to take along and still adhere to the enterprise needs. That was the first reason to start making those use cases for productivity or for quality increase. And I think that is something that we have to take into account, and that's also where we are working on with our own companies and many others.
And to OpenAI's like credit, they released a very robust prompt engineering guide for GPT-5 shortly after the release. So I think they kind of noticed, or maybe they are fully aware.
Sympathy from Abraham.
I'll make a quick comment on the emotional intelligence piece as well that Abraham was talking about. So I think we need to get to a point where, just like we do this with with dating apps, right? You're trying to find your, like, how close you are to a particular person and so on and so forth. And we've tried to create a science out of dating here, right? So I think that that's going to happen with AI intelligence models and stuff like that as well. Most of us tend to be able to choose the voice of the avatar that you're talking to with Gemini or ChatGPT and others. I think there'll be some, there should be some features that are added to make sure that I can tune the AI assistant to my style, to my tone, and so on and so forth, that gel better. And that would have a lot of implications on, hey, I'm a Republican or a Democrat, so I need this kind of a personality, which means that you are going to have an adverse reaction to news that comes in this direction, and so on and so forth. So I think over time, we'll start to be able to create a long-term memory, create a set of learnings and stuff that I want in this particular AI before it starts connecting with me. MIT recently released a new benchmark for emotional intelligence as well. And I think we'll see a lot more of these to in addition to all the math and stuff that you're doing. Are you emotionally intelligent? Do you actually truly understand what I really need? Not the questions that are coming out of my mouth, right? If my daughter asks me something, in my head, I'm always trying to unpack what she really, really means, not what she's just asking for. So I think we'll get to a point as a community where emotional intelligence, tailoring that experience to our own style and so on and so forth, that's going to be a big part of how these AIs get rolled out. So people have less separation anxiety from, hey, my 4.0 and my new GPT-5 is different. I could have just said, I want my 4.0 personality, click a button, transfer it over to the new with GPT-5 and I'm done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's like, it definitely feels like we're going to push towards customization because of this problem. Because I think ultimately, like, this is a really fascinating problem because I think it's almost downstream of the fact that it is conversation, right? Which is basically that, like, with Google, I have to say, I've never been like, oh, they updated Google, something's different. Or like, man, it just isn't the same interacting with the Google search bar, right? But with a conversation, you really kind of start to be like, oh, there's a person I'm interacting with is kind of like the prior that you have. And I think that's kind of the interesting problem that we have with this interface, is that this interface comes with all this additional baggage that is hard to navigate. I guess maybe in the last few minutes, Sophie, maybe I'll turn to you. We got a little bit off track with my original prompt, which I think is worth kind of talking a little bit about, is should we read GPT-5 as an indication that things are plateauing or slowing down? Because there has been, I feel like, a general vibe, I guess, you know, outside of any metrics, that, you know, this was an improvement, but not a huge quantum leap that we were promised. And I think there's one point of view, which is this is OpenAI overpromising and people are disappointed. The other view is, well, they tried really hard and now we're in this plateau. I'm curious if there's one, you know, sort of theory that you ascribe to more.
Well, I think the expectations indeed, and that's the marketing part and that is there. But I think it's also, I think there's still a giant leap to take from the current GPT use for consumer or citizen use towards enterprise use. And I think with this step, they are definitely coming closer to more of that. And with the memory and other features that are built in here, so I think in from that sense, it's definitely a step forward for the OpenAI coming closer to enterprise. But yeah, there's a lot of expectation setting, so that is so it's also good to understand. What kind of new users are they looking for? How do they want to grow further? And then relate back to those expectations again.
Abram, I think I'll give you the last word here. I think the question I really wanted to end on was, you know, people have been looking forward to GPT-5 for a very, very long time. And I feel a little bereft now that the announcement has happened. I'm like, what else am I looking forward to? What's the next big AI, you know, announcement to be had? Looking past GPT-5, are there particular things that you are excited about? Like, what's the thing that I should wake up being like, oh, is GPT-5 out yet? Yeah. What's that thing?
I feel like model releases like a dopamine trip right now.
Uh-huh, sure.
Just waiting for the next hit.
Or is GPT-6? It's very
yeah,
easy.
I mean, to your earlier question in terms of have we hit a wall? I think scaling laws, no one can argue that scaling laws have kind of, the diminishing returns are there. You're starting to see kind of a congregation of certain models at the top with, you know, 0.1, 0.2 difference. So in terms of what comes next, I'm more excited about some of the things that we're doing on top of models. So I think what GPT-5 did really cool, and you know, obviously plug for IBM here with Project M, is wrapping, like, you know, being programmatic about how we inference models and really wrapping software around the inferencing. So kind of an extension of test time compute where you're throwing inference at the compute. Now, if we were to throw some software or programming around how we actually take the output or route inputs through different models to get the, you know, particular, answer a particular question, or, you know, put in policies or governance requirements as part of what you want to have your model perform. I think for me, that's really kind of cool. And I think I'm excited to see the next iteration of what that looks like, as opposed to what's the next LLM that's going to drop and what's the next benchmark that's going to be showcased as part of this LLM.
Well, cool. This is a great episode. I'm glad we got into a number of different points. And the discussion went in a couple of different directions, but I think we hit on some really, really good stuff here. So Abraham, Shobit, thanks for joining us as always. And Sophia, we'll hope to have you back on MOE at some point. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.